Welcome to We Got Balls, real, raw, masculine sex talk with Chris Inman and Scott Cohn. Chris and Scott both work with men who want to leave their unwanted sexual struggles in the past. They are willing to do whatever it takes to help men get curious about what drives their compulsive sexual behavior. With that said, here we go.
Well, hey guys, welcome back to another episode of We Got Balls. And today what we want to do is help you reframe what you think about when you struggle. And guess what? We're human beings. Scott, last time I checked, still human beings, right?
Yeah. I mean, I may have some cybernetic parts here and there, but yeah, mostly human.
Yeah. You wish. They don't make robo penises yet. So, too bad. That advertisement was a scam. So what we're going to be doing today is talking about relapse, which is what we talked about in our last episode, but we're going to be looking at it from a little bit of a different perspective. Last time we talked about loving your relapse, and today we want to talk about learning from your relapse. What can your relapse teach you? And I promise you in this episode, if you want to know what it means to understand the lessons that failure provides, you're going to want to stick around, because failure is one of those teachers that we struggle to listen to. We really want to just define that word and say, you know, that means I'm a piece of shit and I should be ashamed of myself and I got to stop doing this. And the greatest invitation in your recovery is when you're weak, when you're broken. And so we want to help you reframe this idea of not only loving your relapse, but learning from it and understanding that there's something different that can happen moving forward after you struggle. So Scott, I know you've had your share of relapses in your life. What are some of the things that you've learned after you've struggled in your own sexual brokenness?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. I guess doing this off the top of my head, I would start with the most important thing that I learned from my relapses was how to have kindness on myself. I had to fundamentally change the posture that I was engaging with myself in the midst of those failures to actually learn from them, because the standard kind of method, which I think is kind of the default setting in our brain, it seems to be, is when we fail, we want to beat ourselves up and we want to punish ourselves so that we never do that thing again. And as the saying goes, beating yourself up for beating off is no way to stop the, that's no way to stop the behavior. And you know that old sign that they used to put on really bad employers, that the beatings will continue until morale improves?
The pirate motto is what they call it, the pirate
so
motto.
So that's kind of the motto, I think, of human nature, is we want to beat ourselves up because we want to punish ourselves to the point where we don't do that thing again. And it's easy to understand how that kind of develops, because our brain has a negative bias built into it. We are more highly attuned to threats or signals of threats or cues of danger than we are to cues of goodness or pleasure or beauty. So for example, let's go back. We're in the caveman era and we're out gathering berries, and you know, we pick some berries and we taste them and they're yummy and sweet, and so we bring those back to our tribe. And then the next day we go out and we find some other berries that look kind of like those, they're a little different, we pick those, take a bite of them, and they make us sick to our stomach and we throw up all over the place. Our brain now is going to associate all of those berries with throwing up and getting sick, because it's more important for a survival standpoint to pay attention to the things that harm us rather than things that help us.
All right. So I think this is a really, really important point to make when it comes to recovery. What you just mentioned is, I think, where most guys operate and really have operated for their entire lives. They've operated on a survival mentality. Let's get real about why we struggle sexually. We go to sexually compulsive behaviors to survive.
That's right.
Not to grow.
What? Sex is not a need, Chris?
What are you talking about? I need it every day. I need it five times a day. Wait, no, that's when my dick falls off. I'm sorry.
Well, wait a second, though. If you grew up in the evangelical church, if there's one thing you heard about sex, it is that it is not a need.
Yeah.
Am I right?
Well, no, actually, I heard the opposite.
Really?
I heard that yeah, I heard that it was a need when you're married.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, when you're married. And that's, you could be, you know, you could meet each other's needs. I think there's a passage in 1 Corinthians about that or something. You could meet each other's needs. Don't deprive one another. It gets twisted and all jacked up. But what I'm talking about is just life. I mean, we know we're talking about it, code word, recovery is code for life. So if you're wondering, why do I have to be in recovery? Well, because you're a human being and you're trying to learn to live. And the ways you were given to live didn't work when you were young. And so you went to all these shameful coping behaviors, and we've gotten into that, where shame comes from, in past episodes, and we'll get there again. But let's camp on this mindset of, my relapse is actually an old way I learned to survive, versus being kind to myself is a new way I'm learning to grow.
Yeah. And really the sexual part of that, you know, the relapse cycle gets a lot of attention because it's sensational and scandalous and naughty. But really, that's just one of many, many survival strategies. And I like to call them survival strategies because it seems like coping behavior seems, I'm kind of weak and I'm passive and I don't have any say in this. I'm just a victim of my coping behaviors. I don't like that. I don't like triggers. Triggers, again, sounds like, oh, I'm a victim. I'm triggered. I can't help myself. Actually, these are things that we did the best job that we could at the time to survive the chaotic environments, the lack of caring environments that we grew up in.
So in the future, when I say coping behaviors, you just get to go survival strategies.
Survival strategy.
You just get to throw that as survival strategies.
Triggers are
cues. Because I agree. These are survival strategies.
Triggers are activation cues.
Right.
So yeah. So we're in survival mode. We're using survival strategies, sexually, relationally, to try to hack our way through life.
Yeah. But and back to my point though, the sexual stuff is the tip of the iceberg. Underneath that, what about your perfectionism? Does that bother you at all? What about your tendency to procrastinate? How about that?
Yes.
What's that doing in terms of your stress level? So like, I know the sexual stuff gets all the attention, but your shame is probably the bigger problem underneath the water level. And it would love for you to just ignore that.
And your low-lying depression and anxiety that carries with you all the time, every day. Those are things that, like you said, we go to the survival strategies to really get over. But the reality is nobody taught us how to grow, Scott. Nobody taught us what growth feels like and looks like. Nobody gave us a model to say, this is how you get from point A to point B as a man. And so what we can learn from our relapses is, first of all, I would say that it takes multiple experiences to grow. I don't get it right the first time. In fact, I'll even say this, I don't get it right anytime. That being right is not the point. For me, what I learned in my relapses was I need connection. Very vividly, in the midst of kind of the worst season of my addiction, I was acting out and I was lying to the guy that I was checking in with. You know, I don't know what we were doing, accountability or some other bullshit, but we would nice talk about stuff. How you doing? Oh, I'm doing great. And I was just bold-faced lying. And after I was starting to get honest, a few months later, I went to him and I said, I'm sorry, I've been lying to you and I've been lying about X, Y, and Z. And I just unburdened myself. And he offered me kindness, which frankly, if he had judged me, I'd have shut him down and never talked to him again. He offered me kindness. And in that, I committed to myself, I need to talk to this guy more often. I need to be more vulnerable with this guy more often. And it was a real blessing to say, I need this connection. Not, oh, it's great to have on top, or I'll get around to it when I get a chance. I need it in order to be healthy and to grow long term.
And the most important thing he was modeling for you is how to talk to yourself in the process of talking to you with kindness.
Ooh, that was good.
Right? Because you up until that point in your life, Chris, you didn't have a lot of experiences with other people where you could be authentic, where you could share, you know, what was really going on, and every part of you was welcome. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
That's exactly right, Scott. I mean, I think where I was in that space was I didn't trust anybody, especially myself, but I didn't trust anybody. And he offered me the opportunity to truly believe that there was a safe place and a need to take those human broken pieces of myself into that safe place so that I could be loved and I could experience kindness.
Now, I'm curious about something. You weren't born not trusting people. You were actually born set to expect care and to expect people to come when you cried and to feed you and change your diaper. And you were born into a world in which you came out looking for care and trust. So what happened, Chris?
Are you saying that I was trusting from my infancy, that I was looking for someone looking for me
from
the very moment that I was born?
That's right. That was your default setting. So what happened to change your setting?
I don't know. I must have learned that at some point along the way, people aren't trustworthy. And when I have a need, maybe just a basic need like my diaper changed or someone to see me when my face is downtrodden, that I can't depend on another person. I got to learn to take care of myself, Scott. I got to take care of my own needs.
Yeah, and if I can put some language around that, your most important need was emotional safety, right? You needed people who could see what was going on in you by reading your face, by reading your cry, your tone of voice, your gaze, your smiles, or your downward cast face, and say, hey, what's going on there? Tickle, 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 you know, or soothe you when you were angry or afraid. It's okay. It's okay. And when you don't get that in a good enough way, which is about 30% of the time is what neuroscientists classify as good enough parenting. When you don't get that over and over again, it takes that setting on your autonomic nervous system and switches it to threat detection mode, and you're on.
Are you saying that I have anxious attachment style, Scott?
Or avoidant. one of the two insecure attachment styles.
I'm on the anxious side.
I'm on the avoidant.
Track,
so either way, there's an anxiety inside. When you have an insecure attachment style, you learn, when I cry, nobody's coming, so I got to take care of myself. Or sometimes they're there and sometimes they're not, and I've got to do really kind of extreme things to get noticed. So I raise up the intensity of my cries or my anger or whatever. So either one of those attachment styles create problems for us in bonding securely with others, but they came from the way we were bonded with first. And that sense of safety, am I emotionally safe in a relationship with those closest to me? So when you don't get that in your family system growing up, and we've talked a lot about family systems, your threat detection mode gets set to very low levels of triggering or activation. And then you're looking for ways to kind of soothe yourself or to stimulate yourself when you're feeling down and shameful. And that's where the addiction starts to creep in.
Yeah. And so in that moment of struggling with the relapse and really just going off the deep end for me, what I learned was that not only did I need connection, but I also needed to pay attention to what my body was doing, was going on in my body as I go throughout my day and read the warning lights.
Okay, can we just stop there for a second? Because
yeah, we're going to camp out, man.
That issue of knowing what's going on in my body, that's a big, huge issue for men in particular, I think.
Yeah.
So how?
Well, because the three emotions that we're given, right, Scott, is, you know, you can be hungry, you can be horny, and you can be angry.
Yes.
Those are your three default masculine emotions. And two of those are not actually emotions, but that's all right.
Yeah.
You know, we sit with guys every day and we look in their faces and they don't know what it means to feel. And in order to feel, you've got to get in touch with what's going on in your body.
So how did you do that? Because that seems to be a really difficult challenge for a lot of guys. And you're absolutely right, is they come in at the start of recovery and you know, you ask them to kind of scan their body and just notice what they're feeling in their body. And they're like, oh, I don't feel anything. I'm like, nothing?
Yeah.
Nowhere?
No.
No. Right? How did you?
I'm fine, Scott. I'm fine. Stop asking me. I'm fine.
I feel nothing. Oh, maybe I'm horny right now.
Yeah.
So how did you build awareness of something that you didn't know you had and you didn't know you were feeling?
I think surrendering to, and I use that word intentionally, surrendering to the process of connection taught me that I need to sit in space with myself and others and begin to attune to what's going on and practice that. What does it feel like? Like my first year or two was just sitting in meetings. And when I used to sit in a meeting, you know what I was thinking the whole time, Scott?
No.
What valuable thing can I say so that these people can like me?
Oh, you were trying to be accepted and belong.
Yes. And so I was always, you know, racking my brain. What can I say? What do they want me to say? So 9 to nothing. And I was totally numbing out what was going on in my body. Mm. And so when I was in recovery for the first few years, I began to just sit and listen. And man, that is an agonizingly slow process to learn to listen. And just to listen not only to what other people were saying, but then eventually I would be quiet enough to listen to what was going on in my own heart, in my own body. And it's not an exact science. I mean, it's not something that, you know, we can offer you a 7-step program to say, this is how you listen to your body. It takes, for some people, especially those severely traumatized, it takes a long time.
So did you have help along the way from other guys who would mirror back to you what they saw or what they read in your body? Like, hey, Chris, it seems like your brow is kind of furrowed. Are you angry right now? That's what it looks like on your face. Did you have that kind of connection where other guys were actually engaging you in that process of attunement where they're reading you?
Well, I think it was incompletely so. Through doing story work, I got some of that. And so I would get it at retreats or we would have the occasional time to sit one-on-one and talk about story stuff. But it wasn't a way, and I think we both learned this, there wasn't a way to do that in group, because group was about content. It was about information. And so we were churning through books and studies and, you know, talking about our circumstances rather than just learning to be with. And I think that word withness or being present, it was something that I picked up along the way as a true value of recovery work, which is, I need to sometimes sit and do exactly what you just said. Observe the facial expressions and the body language of the man that I'm with and reflect it back to him.
So another thing that I'm hearing kind of here is what you learn from your recovery is to focus on what you're feeling instead of what you're thinking.
And that, I don't, what are you talking about? How do I get to that? I mean, that's, yes, you're right. But my feelings were like one of the last things, maybe the second to last things to really show up. Let me just give you a cheat sheet. I came into recovery focused on my behavior, numb to my feelings, and being ignorant of what was going on in my body.
And just trying to use the top of your brain to change.
Absolutely. You know, if I can think my way into doing something differently, then that's all. I need one magic truth to shock me. Pew! And then I'm
going to cognitive this shit all the way to success.
Yeah, 4 to 6 weeks. That's all I needed, four to six weeks. Here I am, you know, 12 years later. Hmm. But that's, so to say, I said the first thing that really shifted with me was an awareness of my emotions. I have feelings. Oh. What are they?
Oh, that is anger.
Yeah. And that little feelings wheel, I think very helpful tool for people who are ignorant of what their feelings are. Again, it's kind of, like you said, top of the mind feelings. Sometimes I'm looking for things, but it gives me options. It helps me fish for my feelings.
And did you notice as you began to become aware of your emotions that they seemed almost overwhelming. It's like the Pandora's box came off and, oh my gosh, I didn't know I was capable of all this emotion.
When I was able to be, to feel safe enough in my body to let it out. And it took me a long, cause dude, I'm religious. I was taught deep in my bones. You don't let that shit out.
Oh, you're allowed to feel, you're allowed to feel happy and that's it.
Oh, exactly. You let the joy of the Lord be your strength.
Brother.
What's triggering about that is that's how my dad's face looks all the time.
Oh man.
Just I can't do it. Yeah. But that's if you're listening on podcast, check out the YouTube channel and see what I'm talking about. But that is the aspect of it is really being aware that feelings are possible, but then beyond that, I think that the hack to feelings is what we were talking about earlier, which was being aware of what was going on in my body, is that when I'm feeling some discomfort right at the top of my stomach, lower esophagus, that's my anxiety kicking in. When I am feeling hot and feeling flushed, that's some anger kicking in. When there's a general tingliness in my body, in my extremities, that there's some aspect of kind of apathy or maybe depression kicking in. And that's specific to me, not universal to everyone. I mean, you can have similarities, but it's being present with those felt senses because, and Scott, you could go on like a 20-minute tangent on this, but give us a couple minutes. What does it mean when I'm thinking with my body? How do my brain and my body relate?
Yeah. I mean, I love how Dan Siegel, who's a really famous interpersonal neurobiologist and has written a lot on this particular subject, kind of sums it up. We sense first with our bodies, and then we make sense out of what we're sensing with our brains. And so the way the human being actually works is things come in through our senses, through our ears, our eyes, our sense of smell, our skin. And then we have something called interoception, which is that internal sense of what's going on in my body. What's my heart and my lungs and my gut telling me? And all of that gets processed together, and then it goes up to the right hemisphere of our brain, and it gets processed as categorical emotions: anger, fear, sadness, shame, happy, tender. Let's just simplify it. Emotions are very nuanced. You can get it as really, you know, you can do the feeling wheel if you want to, but you don't need to. If you want to start somewhere, start with your body. What am I feeling in my chest? What am I feeling in my gut right now? What about my throat? What about my face? And just noticing, what are the physical sensations? Are they intense or subtle? Are they pleasant or are they unpleasant? If I was to describe them in terms of physical properties, would I say this is tightness, or would I say it's relaxed? Would I say it's pressure, or would I say it's an expansiveness? Just try to get a handle on a couple of times a day, stopping down and going, I'm going to check in with my body right now. What's my body telling me?
But see, even as you're talking about that, my intellectual self, my shame driven self goes, that's just a bunch of psychobabble mumbo jumbo. I just feeling in my body. What are you talking about? I mean, what's the real link for me in my recovery between doing that work? I mean, what does that really profit me?
Well, you're fundamentally acting out in any way, whether it's procrastination, whether it's perfectionism, whether it's pornography and masturbation, whatever, all of that is an attempt to control what's really going on in your body, the physical sensations that are generating an impulse, that are working together to create emotions that then drive you to that survival strategy to get rid of the bad feelings and have good feelings in some sense. So it really is, you're sensing first here, and then you're trying to make sense out of it up here. And if you start with your body, you're going to have a really effective way of starting to get in a position of actually understanding what's going on in you and then having a sense of agency over that. Like, it's not like when I feel a churning in my stomach, I can't do anything about it. I can if I pay attention to it. And sometimes I'll even have guys start off by doing a body scan, and then they'll go, oh, I feel a churning in my stomach. I say, put your hand there. And this may sound silly to you, but just say out loud, what are you trying to tell me? And then just pay attention to what floats up to your awareness. And it's amazing how many times guys will say, I'm really worried about this thing coming up today. Oh, well, that makes perfect sense, doesn't it? That your stomach would be churning in anxiety over that. And so it takes a kind friend or guide who knows how to do this to kind of guide you into this process. But I got to tell you, the Bible had this before anybody in modern neurobiology does, because the Apostle Paul says, present your bodies as a living sacrifice to God, and then don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. If you want to renew your mind, you better start with your body and pay attention to what's going on in here. Present that body. And so to me, this process is so spiritual. It's so biblical. It's so in tune with interpersonal neurobiology, because we are sensing creatures first and foremost. And what we do in our childhood development kind of traumas, the process of being ignored, the process of being neglected, the process of being abused, we tend to shut feelings off because they're too overwhelming to deal with. I'm not going to feel that. I don't want to feel that. I'm not going to be angry. My anger wasn't allowed in my home. I couldn't say to my mom and dad, that fucking sucks, because I would have been smacked Scott, across the mouth.
Scott, that language, Scott.
Yeah, right.
I mean, that's what I think as you're talking about it. It's so much slower. It's so much more. And I'll just say that it's faithful. I have to surrender parts of the process that I can't control and don't understand. Yeah. And say, okay, when I'm putting my hands on my stomach, it doesn't make sense to me, but we'll try this out and see how it works.
Yeah. And it's amazing when guys do that, they just, ooh, this is awesome.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's almost like surrender is part of the process.
Yeah.
It's part of the growth process.
Crazy.
And I think I'll introduce this as well, is that when we think about recovery, it's not linear. I know what I learned in my own journey of recovery is that there are seasons. There's times when I move quickly forward and I feel really connected and feel on kind of, if you want to put some religious language, I feel on fire, right? I feel like everything's working. And then there's times where it just feels like the wilderness and I'm just disconnected and I'm sad. And that doesn't mean that I've left the journey or that I'm doing something wrong. It just means I have to accept that there's different things going on in my circumstances, different things going on in my body. I'm getting older and changing. My relationships are changing. One of the most helpful phrases that I was given, and I think we live by, is relationships change over time. Few relationships are permanent. I used to think that because someone wasn't my friend anymore, that there was something wrong with me.
Boy, that's really hard. I mean, that's hard. That's a hard thing to absorb, because we want, there's something in us that longs for permanence, don't you think? Like we're longing for that. Oh, I want to be his friend forever. And I want to just enjoy these moments of goodness together. And like C.S. Lewis said, when there's a desire in us that's not met in this life, it's an indication there's some life beyond this that was meant to fulfill that desire. That's to me what heaven and the resurrection is for, is to be able to have those lingering, ongoing relationships forever. And we have to grieve that when we're losing that here. But the thing I would go back to is where we started in the first place, is you can always start when you're in those seasons of, I don't know what's going on. I don't know why I feel stuck. That's a common one, right? I just feel stuck. Where do you go in your stuckness? I think the first place you go is kindness. What is kind to my body right now? What does my body need? Maybe you need a warm bath. Maybe you need to go get a massage at a decent, healthy massage place, not the kind that
legitimate massage parlor.
Not a happy ending. Maybe
like me, sometimes I just need a hug, and I've had to cultivate spaces and places for someone to just give me that sense of care and nurture.
And it may be more than a three taps and I'm not gay and you're out.
I don't do those.
You
I just You know what I do now? I do the slidey lingery hug. Like I put my hands around and I kind of rub a little bit.
Oh, so yeah.
If someone's a little homophobic, they're going to feel really awkward. Bro, my hugs.
I've been hugged by you. I like your hugs.
Yeah. I mean, I'm here to stay. I'm not going anywhere. What do I got to do?
That may create a little arousal in some guys, Chris, but
that's all right. That's all right. I'll love you that just, arousal. Be kind to that. You just and not
stand back a little. There's no judgment there. So.
I mean, you know.
But yeah,
your reality is I'll never know for most guys anyway.
So the question, unless it's me and I'll go, hey, I got a boner. No,
you'll tell me.
So, what's kind to your body right now? That is the question I love to ask guys. Like, what would be kind to your body right now? What would feel good in your body? A hot shower, a walk in nature, just being quiet, listening to the birds, feeling the sunlight on your skin. Like a lot of times, and I, again, to bring some biblical stuff into this, Elijah was a depressed guy. He had a lot of anxiety and depression. Great prophet, does some amazing, miraculous stuff, make a great movie. And then he runs away from this wicked woman because he's scared to death of her. And he realizes he's no better than everybody else. He's just a dude. And you would think God would come to him and go, get up. You're one of my top prophets. You just slayed 450 prophets of Baal, called fire down from hell. What is wrong with you? That's not what God did. God sends an angel.
God doesn't ask that question. What is wrong with you? No. Or questions like, well, why are you letting me down? Or why can't you just do what I told you
to? I am so disappointed in you, Elijah. God sent,
not a question that God asked.
God sends an angel to give him a little jar of water, a little snack. Here, why don't you take a nap? That was kindness.
Very much so.
Just sometimes the kind thing you need to do is have a little snack and have a little nap. And then get up and have another snack and nap and sleep some more. Because maybe that's what your body needs.
Yeah.
So paying attention to your body. Being kind to your body, being kind to yourself, your own heart, being kind to the ways that you learn to survive in your growing up years because nobody was paying attention to you or the attention they were giving you wasn't very healthy. And then staying connected.
Yeah.
Do not withdraw.
Yeah. And that's just so tempting and shame to just pull back. So one of the things I'd like to close us with is that when we talk about relapse, we learn through second chances best. Through falling down and getting up, falling down and getting up, falling down and getting up. I mean, you think about how you learn to do anything in this life.
How'd you learn to ride a bike? You didn't start riding a bike guy going, ooh, look at me.
Scott, it's everything. Walk, ride a bike, relationships, jobs. Tests. I mean, nobody gets it right the first time. So to be ashamed and to move back into shame and performance and procrastination, whatever it is, when we fall down, is just a reflection of the embodied shame that we carry. And your kindness medicine is a different way of looking at this. When I can be kind to my brokenness and get back up, I can have it mean something. And everybody's got a story, past and present, that you're working in, that's going to allow you to bring meaning to your failures. Failure does not define you. Failure is your opportunity to grow. So just invite you to that as you learn from your relapse. Great metaphor. Scott and I both used it. When you mess up, think of it like this. It's a warning light on the dashboard of your car. If a warning light on the dashboard of your car comes on, do you like slam your car into a ditch and punch the dashboard and just get furious? I'm so mad. I'm so mad that you came on. Why are you doing
this? Light it on fire, burn it to the ground.
Light it on fire, blow it up, right? No, you take it to the shop or you go to the auto parts place and have them run a little scan on it. What's going on? Is it minor? Is it major? What's going on? Curiosity is the invitation in relapse. Not judgment. And when we're curious and when we're kind, then we can really learn to do things differently the next time? What do I need to address that's powering this behavior? And you go back and you go back again and you go back again. And guess what? You're going to go back 100 times. You might go back 1,000 times before you really learn to trust others in the journey of recovery and learn to really love yourself well. So there's so much here. We could spend a whole weekend. Maybe we will spend a weekend on relapse weekend. Sometimes you guys can come and do a live with us and we'll talk about this ad nauseum and ask all the crazy questions. Just go cover it all. That'd be a good time.
We should do a relapse weekend. Yeah, we should do that.
Yeah, that'd be good. So we'll get to that. As all things, you know, it's on the dream board. So we'll see what happens. But we look forward to connecting with you guys. If you haven't done this already, please subscribe and share. I heard from a guy yesterday who heard about the podcast from a guy who was in a recovery app that he was using. Won't call out the app, but they were connecting and they said, "Hey, why don't you check out We Got Balls?" And he's like, been a true blessing. You know what episode really connected with him, Scott?
I do not, Chris.
Anal sex.
Well, frankly, awesome.
I mean, who knows? It's different flavors for different folks. Go back to the catalog, see what episodes you connect with, share them with your friends. We want to be curious, kind and vulnerable together as we seek authenticity in our recovery. And so check us out on successfulmen.com if you have the opportunity to do that and see how you could get invested in one of our groups. Where what do every week, Scott, in our Successful Men groups?
We give kindness and tell stories
and attune to our bodies.
Yes.
Every single week. So we hope you will be benefited by that or this podcast or whatever. So Scott,
Chris, join us here next time on We Got Balls. This would be me passing it to you.
All right. Try that again. Go join us here next time on We Got Balls.
Join us next time here on We Got Balls.
And you do too, guys. Take care, everybody.
Don't forget to subscribe for more episodes. You can connect with Chris and with Scott at successfulmen.com.